Good morning. Take your Bible and turn with me to Job chapter 1, and we'll get there in a few minutes. You know, if you look across the landscape of our world, you look across your desk at work, you look across the street, you look in the mirror, no one would argue the fact that life in this broken world is hard. Life is punctuated with hardship and heartaches and headaches and health problems, sometimes your own, sometimes of people that you love and care about. Sometimes it's not just one thing, but it's one thing after another, and there's no relief in sight, and a lot of times it just seems so unfair. Put yourself into this scenario. You're a single parent living 1,200 miles from a job offer that comes to you from Houston, Texas. So you apply for the job and you get it and you thank God for it because as far as you can discern, God's obviously opened this door for you. And you and your three children, all under the age of 15, moved to Houston for a much better job, a higher paying job, for a much bigger company that seems to have a bright future. Before you left, you called all your friends together. You told them how God had worked in your life to open the door, and they were sad to see you go, but they're happy that your prayers to better provide for your kids has been answered. So you make the move. You start working for Enron. You enjoy your work. You catch on quickly. It's challenging. The company rewards you for your diligence. You're doing so well. The company's doing so well that you decide to invest what little retirement money you have in company stock. Then one day you hear some troubling comments in the break room, but you kind of put them out of your mind. I mean, after all, your retirement funds are there, your health benefits are there, your financial security is there. But then just a few days later, your boss calls you in and she lets you go with no explanation. And you're crushed. I mean, you're confused. You have no idea what's going on until you start to hear the story unfold on the evening news. You lose everything. Your world, your whole world is coming unraveled. You were doing a good job. It's not your fault. You moved for all the right reasons. Plus, you felt like God was leading you in that direction, but now you are about to lose your house. You have no idea how you're going to explain all this to your kids. And then a week later, you're showering and you find a small lump under your left breast. You feel like you're just going to throw up. You can't believe it. 2 days later, the biopsy reveals you have an aggressive malignancy. Oh, I failed to mention that 3 years ago, your husband ran off with a much younger and attractive assistant, and they're doing great. They both have new cars, well-paying jobs, no kids, and enjoy exotic vacations. But you have to move in with your aging parents who are not in the best of health themselves. Their little home has just 3 bedrooms, so it's all 6 of you together there. You got to go through surgery and months of chemo. It's too much. I mean, as a follower of Christ, all kinds of things run through your mind. I mean, God, why? Why is this happening to me? I don't get it. I thought I was doing what you wanted me to do. I mean, what did I do to deserve this? And there are days where you're really angry with God. You're like, God, this isn't what I signed up for. I mean, this is not the abundant life that Jesus promised. This is not why I have stayed faithful all these years. God, it's just plain unfair. Now, if you can kind of put yourself into a scene like that, you're coming close to a scene like we are going to be seeing in the book of Job. If this is your first time with us today, we want to welcome you. We're glad you're here. We've just started a short sermon series from the Old Testament book of Job, and the book deals with the whole idea of undeserved suffering. I hope you have a category, a theological category for undeserved suffering, because if you don't, you'll never understand the book of Job. This book allows us to peek in, to observe how a righteous man named Job handles the emotional grief and physical pain that God allows to come into his life. I mean, catastrophic tragedies that would cause some of us to abandon our faith because God never answered our why questions. And contrary to popular opinion, this book really does not give us an answer to our why questions. It's not really about suffering. This book is about God and how God runs the world. I like how Philip Yancey puts it in his book, Disappointment with God. He writes, Job is not primarily about the problem of pain, not primarily about suffering. Suffering contributes to the ingredients of the story, not its central theme. Just as a cake is not about eggs and flour and milk and shortening, but uses those ingredients in the process of creating a cake, Job is not about suffering. It merely uses the ingredients of terrible grief, unbearable pain, undeserved suffering in its larger story, which concerns even more important questions, which I would say are these. How are we supposed to think about God and respond to God when we experience undeserved suffering? How are we supposed to think about God? How are we supposed to respond to God when unexplained, undeserved suffering comes into our life or the life of someone we care about? That is what Job is going to help us think through. As we said last week, in the book of Job, Job is not the one on trial. Job has trials, but he's not on trial. He's declared righteous from the very beginning of the book and declared righteous at the very end of the book. God is the one on trial in this book. His policies are on trial. You say, what policies? Well, his policies as to how he governs the world. See, the question in the book of Job is not why do bad things happen to good people, but how are you supposed to think about God when bad things happen to good people like you? Job is wisdom literature. It was written for our instruction to teach us to think wisely about God and life and faith. And this is so very important. We closed last week with the A.W. Tozier quote where he says, whatever comes into your mind when you think about God is the most important thing about you. How you think about God is the most important thing about you, because how you think about God will shape your response to both the good things and the bad things that God permits to come into your life. Now, last week we learned from the first five verses that Job was a blameless man, not sinless. Blameless doesn't mean sinless. He was a man, though, of great integrity. He was upright, meaning that he dealt fairly and compassionately with people. He was a man who feared God and turned away from evil, which is the very definition of a wise man from chapter 28, verse 28, and also in the book of Proverbs. We learn that Job had a big family, seven sons, three daughters, meaning he was very blessed, over the top blessed as a family man. He had great wealth, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and many, many servants. And the storyteller sums all that up by telling us that Job was the greatest man in all of the East. And we saw that Job was very conscientious, maybe overly conscientious. We looked at verses 4 and 5 last week, and we saw how that when his adult children would celebrate a birthday, that Job would make sacrifices for each one of them, just in case, maybe possibility, there was the outside chance that one or more of them sinned and cursed God in their hearts. So just to be sure, to cover all the bases, Job offered sacrifice to atone for their maybe possibly sins. And so we see that Job has a very high view of God, but it seems like all of us, there was a slight flaw in his thinking about God that caused him at times to walk on eggshells with God. Now, where would that kind of thinking come from? Well, Job believed in what many students of the Bible refer to as the retribution principle or the retribution formula, which I discussed last week. The retribution formula is if you do good, you get good. If you do bad, you get bad. Corollary, if you get bad, it means you've been bad or done bad. That's the way all the people in Job's day and many people in our day understand God's justice. It is a cause and effect, reward and punishment policy. So the retribution policy is that, or according to the policy, God doles out prosperity and misery in direct proportion to how good you are or how bad you are. It's like karma. Whatever goes around comes around. Many of you may remember these clips from Saturday Night Live.
And now, Deep Thoughts by Jack Handy.
If a kid asks where rain comes from, I think a cute thing to tell him is, God is crying. And if he asks why God is crying, another cute thing to tell him is, probably because of something you did.
Well, Jack Handy believes in the retribution principle. You do good, you get good. You do bad, you make God cry, and then God makes you cry. Now, the whole book of Job revolves around this policy. Now, look at Job 1-6, because we're going to study from 1-6 to 2-10. By the way, how many of you started reading Job this week? Okay, good. More of you can start this week. I'm challenging you to read Job three times as we move through this seven-week series. If you don't get through it this week, at least try to read chapters 1 through verse 27, because next week the message will come from chapter 3 to 27. We're going to cover 3 to 27 next week. And I guarantee you, if you read the book as we're going through the series, it will make much more sense to you. Now, in chapters 1:6 to 2:10, there are two scenes that take place in heaven, two scenes that take place on earth. And in heaven, there's a discussion between God and Satan that deals with Job's motivation for living a righteous life. And as a result of that discussion, what takes place on earth is Job loses his wealth, his family, and his health. I mean, it's shocking. It's hard to get your mind around. At the same time, it's easy to run off in all kinds of different directions that will cloud the big idea that we're supposed to take away from this text. And so as we move through the passage, I'm going to highlight two mistakes that we can make in interpreting this passage that will make the big idea harder to see. Verse 6, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Now, I don't take the sons of God here to be angels. It's not the word for angels. Angels are messengers. So here you have something else. We know from other scriptures there are all kinds of heavenly beings, and according to other scriptures, the scene that's painted here is the picture of some kind of heavenly council meeting or heavenly cabinet meeting. And the text says that Satan shows up for the meeting. Why he's there, we don't know. Verse 7, the Lord said to Satan, where you been? And Satan answers the Lord, oh, just going to and fro across the earth. I've just been walking around, you know. And so here's the first mistake. You have to be really careful here. Do not read into this passage everything you know about Satan from the New Testament. Why not? First of all, the term Satan here is not a proper name. Literally, in the Hebrew text, it is the Satan. What's that mean? It means the emphasis in the Old Testament is not on the being we know from the New Testament to be Satan or the devil. The emphasis is on the function this person or this being is carrying out. He's the adversary, the accuser, the challenger. And I'm in order to focus on that, I'm going to call him the challenger from this point forward. Because you see, in the Old Testament, there are very few references even to the Satan. The term the devil is never used in the Old Testament, and this is important. Nowhere in the long, drawn-out dialogues between Job and his friends does the idea of a personal, supernatural, evil person come up. It's not until Jesus met Satan in his wilderness temptations that we see Satan as a personal, evil enemy. So ancient believers did not have a fully developed understanding of Satan as a personal being. They simply understood that there was a being who came into the heavenly courts who functioned in a challenging kind of role. So what's the point? The point is we need to read the text and understand the text the way the first readers understood it. And they would have put the emphasis, or they would not have put the emphasis on Satan like we understand him today. They would put the emphasis, and also they would not put the emphasis on spiritual warfare like we understand it today. They would have simply read this text and focus on what the challenger says and is permitted to do. The focus is not on him, the focus is on God. So, and if we don't stay focused on that, we can run off all into all kinds of different directions about who Satan is and spiritual warfare, and that's not what this text is about. Now, we can certainly read forward from this text to understand the New Testament Satan as he's presented to us, but we should not read backward into this text everything we know, or the cloud, the big idea. Verse 8, "And the Lord said to the challenger, 'Have you considered my servant Job?'" Calling Job my servant is high praise from God, and that flows into even higher praise, an echo of what we read earlier. God says, "There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." So God affirms that Job is a righteous man, and that sets up everything that's about to happen in the book. The point is, Job does not deserve what's coming, and God makes that clear. And that's why the challenger challenges this. Verse 9, the challenger answers the Lord and says, "Does Job really fear God for no reason?" Now you need to circle that, underline it, highlight it. Does Job fear God for no reason? This is the big idea. This is what the passage is all about. It's what drives the whole book. The emphasis focuses on this question, this challenge. And this is a direct assault on God's retribution policy. Does Job really fear God for nothing? Assumption, of course not. How could he? The challenger says in verse 10, "You put a hedge of protection around him, his house, and all that he has. Why would he not live a righteous life the way you have rewarded him?" So notice in verse 10, there are three categories. The challenger says, "You protected him," meaning protected his body from illness. "You protected his house," his family, "from harm. You protected his possessions from destruction." And not only have you protected him, you've blessed him. You've blessed the work of his hands. You've greatly multiplied his possessions and spread his fame all across the land. I say, the challenger asserts, Job lives a righteous life because you've rewarded him with great riches. And here's the wager. Stretch out your hand. Take away all that he has, and he'll curse you to your face. Take away all that you have given him, and he will curse you to your face. Now, what happens next is nothing short of shocking. Verse 12, "And the Lord said to the challenger, 'Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand.'" In other words, don't touch him physically. So, the challenger says, "Stretch to God, stretch out your hand." God turns around and says, "I put him into your hands." That's a terrifying thought. God says, "All he has is in your hand." God is giving permission to the challenger to bring undeserved suffering and heartache into Job's life. He gives permission with limits. That's very important. He gives permission with limits. So you see, God is in complete control of what's going on here. You cannot touch him physically. You can take away his wealth, even his family, but stay away from him. That's the limit. Now hear me, because I can hear you. You're wondering, is that what's behind all my troubles? Is that why I lost my job? Is that why I lost my home? Is that why I lost my child? I mean, did God and Satan enter into some kind of bet, some kind of wager to see if I would cave under pressure? No, 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 no. You cannot draw that conclusion from this text. This is mistake number two. This is a one-time event. How do I know that? Because this whole thing is not about Job. It's about God and his policies. And the challenger is saying to God, "Your policies to reward the righteous and punish the wicked make it impossible for any human being to love you and serve you and worship you without selfish motives." That's what's going on. The challenger's question is, does anyone ever live a righteous life apart from self-interest? He's saying, your so-called followers love you for the things that they can get from you. They don't love you for yourself. They love you for themselves. And the point is, God's policies are going to be shown to be just and wise. And once his policy stands unquestioned for all time and eternity, there is such a thing as unselfishly motivated righteousness, then this scene doesn't have to be repeated. It never again will be repeated. As believers, now, yes, we know that God tests our faith. We know that He refines our faith through trials. We know that He permits suffering to come into our lives for His good purposes of growing us and maturing us and forming us. We know He brings good out of bad. We know all that from New Testament teaching. And we even see that in the Old Testament, like when God tests Abraham with Isaac, and when God tests Israel in the wilderness. That's not what's going on here in Job. Again, in this book, God is the focus, not Job's trials and not us. God is on trial, and these scenes in heaven that we see, but Job never sees, are not meant to be an explanation for why things go wrong in our lives. In other words, if they don't serve as an explanation for Job's suffering, we certainly should not think of them as explanations of our own. Let me put it this way. Job 1 and 2 are simply descriptions of what happened in Job's life. They are not prescriptions for what happens in ours. Job 1 and 2 are simply descriptions of what happens in Job's life. They are not prescriptions or explanations for what we see happen in ours. That would be a terrible mistake to take out of this text. Okay, now, the scene moves from heaven to earth. Now there was a day when Job's sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the oldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing, and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon him and took him and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone escaped to tell you about it." And bam! While he was still speaking, another came in. The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them all, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Bam! While he was still speaking, there came another and said, "The Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped." And bam! While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "Your sons and daughters were drinking wine in the oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell. And all of your children are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you." I cannot fathom all that. Can you? I mean, it's like bam, 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 bam. And Job loses everything, his children, his wealth, his status. His whole world comes unraveled. Two natural disasters, lightning and a tornado-like wind, and two criminal acts of theft and violence from enemy raiding parties that steal all the livestock and kill all but four of his servants. Remember, Job has no idea why this is happening to him. He knows nothing about what's going on behind the scenes in the unseen world. He's given no explanation, as if more information would soothe the unbearable emotional turmoil and shock that's setting in on him. And what does he do? Verse 20, Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head. Those were expressions of deep grief and mourning. And then he fell on the ground and he worshiped God. He worshiped God. Verse 21, he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord, He's taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And the storyteller says, in all of this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Now, I'm going to come back to Job's amazing response here after the next round hits him. But right now, I just want you to see this. The challenger confidently boasted, "Take away all he has and he'll curse you to your face." But did Job do that? No. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrongdoing. Now, you need to hang on to that thought, but let's keep going. Because the challenger isn't finished. He's out to prove that God's policies motivate people to live faithful lives because of the rewards they can get from God, and they can escape the punishment from being bad. So in chapter 2, we have the same scene repeated. Verse 1, there was a day. Now, by the way, that phrase, "there was a day," is used to introduce both scenes in heaven. Now, that helps me see that this story is written as a story. Not that it's not true. Last week we said Job is a real man who lived in a real place at a real time. But think, there are no days in heaven. God resides in eternity. No days there. And what's written here I think, is written in a way that we can understand. Like the rest of the book, the conversations have all been written and crafted as poetry. Real events crafted as poetry. I think these heavenly scenes have been written so we can imagine that something like this happened, but I don't think we can really get our minds around exactly what did happen. So the author writes it in a way that we can understand. So in chapter 2, we have the same heavenly scene, nearly the same initial conversation between God and the challenger, but with this difference. God says in verse 3, Job still holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him for no reason. Now look at this. First of all, God brags on Job. He says he still holds fast to his integrity, meaning, you see, I mean more to Job than his stuff, even his family. And God makes it clear that Job did not deserve the suffering God permitted the challenger to bring into his life. He said, you incited me against him for no reason. So the challenger ups the ante. Verse 4, skin for skin. All that a man has, he'll give for his life, but stretch out your hand and touch his bone and flesh, and he'll curse you to your face. Challenger says, sure, Job can endure the loss of his property, even his children. But you take away his health, that's different. That's much worse. Take away his health, he'll curse you to your face. Again, the statement implies that Job lives a selfishly motivated, righteous life. Now, you would think, you almost want to say, well, if I was God, I would say, enough is enough. I mean, you had your chance, you were proved wrong, end of story, move on. But God lets the challenger take Job's suffering one horrible step further. Verse 6, and the Lord said to Satan, behold, he's in your hand. Only spare his life. Again, permission with limits. So the challenger went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, and he took a piece of pottery with which to scrape himself, and he sat in the ashes. I can't get my mind around how much pain Job suffers here. We don't know how long it was between the first set of disasters and this new one. My guess, just watching what's going on, I would guess it may have very well been long enough for Job and his wife to start to recover, and then, bam, they get hit again. No one knows exactly what these loathsome sores actually are. Some say smallpox. Others say leprosy. Some say something called pemphigus foliaceus, which if you Google images of that disease, they're horrible. It might give you some picture of the condition that Job may have had. We really don't know for sure what it was. But if you read through the book of Job, Job paints a picture of the misery that he's going through. He says that he is inflamed with ulcerous sores in 2:7, persistent itching in 2:8, degenerative changes in facial skin and disfiguration, 2:12. Loss of appetite, 3:24. Depression, 3:25. Insomnia, 4:13 to 14. Sores that burst open, scab over, crack, ooze with pus, and worms that live in the sores, 7:25. Difficulty breathing, 9:18. Darkened eyelids, 16:16. Bad breath, 19:17. Loss of weight, 19:17. Fever and chills, 21:6. Restlessness, 30:17. Diarrhea, 30:27. Blackened skin that rots off the body, 30:30. And it appears that this went on for months and months before his friends show up. In 7:3, Job speaks about his months of emptiness. In 29:2, he looks back on the months of old when things were good. And on top of that, Job's horrible skin condition would result in Job being rejected and isolated, forced to live outside the city. He talks about that in chapter 19, verses 13 to 20. He lives outside the city in the garbage dump, in the ashes of a place where they burned rubbish and human excrement, along with other people just like him and wild dogs, all fighting over any scrap of food that could be found. I want you to think about this is the city's leading citizen, a man known far and wide as the greatest man in all the East. He's now living in abject poverty. Everyone despised him. After all, they all believed he must have done something terrible to deserve this kind of treatment from God. So here he is, living in total confusion, complete isolation, unbearable pain, no hope of change, sitting in filth. No, he is not lying at home in a bed being taken care of by his wife and his four other servants. He hits rock bottom in every way possible. Verse 9, then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity?" Now that's what God bragged on Job about. God's exact word, he still holds fast to his integrity. She adds, just curse God and die. And that's what the challenger said that Job would do. Curse God. See, she echoes both God's words and the challenger's words. Now, in this story, this is a tense moment. Some commentators say Job's wife was speaking to him out of compassion. I don't think so. You remember last week, Reverend Roosevelt Franklin summed up the book of Job as, "I can't eat by day, I can't sleep by night, and the woman I love don't treat me right." I think he is right. She believes in the retribution principle as well. She no doubt is thinking he's done something dreadful to deserve all this. Think of her question. Are you still holding fast to your integrity? Do you still believe that you're innocent before God? No, to my thinking, she's saying, Job, just get it over with. Just say the words. Go ahead, curse God and die, which again would be the expected consequence of the retribution policy. Now, again, there's tension in this story right here because everything hangs on what Job says next. If Job follows her advice, he'll show that he's been living for God's blessing rather than God himself, exactly what the challenger boldly said. Claimed. And following her advice would mean God's policies do corrupt the motives of righteous people. In that case, the challenger wins. So what does Job do? Verse 10, he rebukes his wife. He says to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speak. Shall we not receive good from God and not receive evil as well, bad as well?" Again, in all of this, the storyteller tells us, in all of this, Job did not sin with his lips. That is, he did not curse God as the challenger predicted he would. So for a second time, Job holds fast to his integrity. His righteousness runs more than skin deep. The challenger is proved wrong. Job finds no fault here in the justice of God. He charges God with no wrongdoing. He sees God in and behind everything that's happening to him, good and bad. And he goes even one step further. He worships God amid the ashes. Now, that's quite amazing. He's not going to stay there, as we'll see as we move forward. But it's an amazing response initially. So the question is, how should chapters 1 and 2 shape our thinking about God and how we should respond to God when life falls apart? What are we supposed to take away from all this? Well, I would say at least these two things. First of all, in this passage, it's clear that nothing ever happens to us that is outside of God's control. Nothing ever happens to you that is outside of God's control. Although God may permit things to happen through secondary causes like natural disasters and acts of violent crime and unexplained illness, even permitting and limiting the challenger here, God stands behind it all. That's how Job sees it. Job believes that God gives and God takes away. And he believes God deserves praise no matter what happens. And when he asks, is it right to receive good things from God and not the bad? Again, the implication is good and bad are to be received as coming from God. See it? For Job, God is in and behind everything that's happened to him, and he believes that God is just and righteous and sovereign over all things. He knows that nothing can come into his life without God's permission. He doesn't understand why all this is happening to him, and as time passes, his acceptance is going to turn to anger, but because he knows he's done nothing to deserve all this, And he's holding to the retribution policy. I've done good. I should get good. How do good people get bad? He doesn't understand that, but he will not. Throughout the rest of the book, as hurt and angry as he becomes, he does not abandon his faith. And the very fact that he argues with God and wrestles with God, it's because he knows God is ultimately responsible. I mean, do you believe that? Do you believe that that nothing ever happens to you outside of God's control? I'm not saying that's a totally satisfying answer to our why question. I don't think it's a real answer to the why question at all. It's just this nugget of theological wisdom that if we allow that truth to shape our thinking about God, then it will set us free from thinking that God has cruel motives or having a lower view of who God is. You see, whenever life falls apart, let this thought, embrace this thought. Nothing ever happens in your life that is outside of God's control. Nothing. Obviously, you don't have to like what's happening to you, but the more our minds are shaped with the truth of God's sovereignty over all things, the easier. It is still hard. It is still hard. But the more this truth permeates our, renews our mind, the easier it becomes to hold fast to God by faith. And the second point ties that theology with faith. Second point. Well, let me ease into it first. When life takes a turn for the worst, we all know how easy it is to blame God and question God. It's easy, and this is where we have to be careful, it's easy for us to think that God is making a real mess of things and that if we were in charge, we could do a better job than running our lives than God, maybe even running the world better than God. We have a God complex, and so we have to pay attention to the thoughts that run across our minds, because when we see unexplained, undeserved suffering, if we're not careful, we can end up having a higher view of ourselves than God. Am I right? I mean, when we start questioning God's justice, we're actually implying, if given the chance, we would be more just. We would be more fair. When we question God's love, we imply, if it were up to us, we would be more loving. I mean, take any attribute of God that doesn't seem to fit when life falls apart. His grace, his patience, his mercy, his kindness, you name it. It's easy to think, well, I'd be more loving than that. I'd be more gracious than that. I'd be more caring than that. I'd be more generous than that. You see, a high view of ourselves, a lower view of God. Most people I meet in coffee shops that I hear complain about all the pain and the suffering that's going on in the world, when the topic of God comes up, they immediately start talking about how unfair God is. And they have a high view of themselves and a low view of God. It's like Bruce's view of God in the movie Bruce Almighty. He says, God is a mean kid sitting on an anthill with a magnifying glass, and I'm the ant. He could fix my life in 5 minutes if he wanted to, but he'd rather burn off my feelers and watch me squirm. Now, sadly, there are a lot of people in our world today, even people in the church today, that would embrace a view of God similar to that. My friend John Walton puts it this way. He says, when we suffer, it's much easier to lower your view of God than to lift your faith even higher. It's easier to lower your view of God than to lift your faith even higher. It's tough to hold on to a high view of God when life starts dragging you down. You see, for me, the questions that I see coming out of the ashes of these two chapters are questions like this. Like, when life falls apart, can a believer lose everything he has? Wealth, family, health, and still hold on to a high view of God through the tears? Can a believer lose everything she is or thought herself to be and still hold on by faith to a God she doesn't understand? You see, to answer those questions in the affirmative requires a strong faith that rises out of the ashes of our suffering. Oh, this is point number two, by the way. In Job, faith means trusting God when there is no apparent reason to do so. Faith means trusting God when there is no apparent reason, no apparent benefit to do so. The truth is, our battle is not with God. Our battle is not with circumstances that He's permitted to come into our lives. The battle is inside us. Job teaches us, at the moment when faith is hardest and least likely, that's when faith is needed most. At the moment when faith is hardest and least likely, that's when we need faith the most. When there are no answers to our why questions, when what God has brought into our lives makes no sense at all, that's when faith is needed most. The question is, now, when unexplained, undeserved suffering wreaks havoc in our lives, the question is, will we trust that God is still good and that His ways are still best? Will we trust Him when it feels like He doesn't care, when it feels like He's become our enemy, when God is silent, when there's no hope or relief in sight, when there's no apparent benefit in holding on? Will we still trust God? Those are tough questions. Questions that call us to embrace an even higher view of God than we had previously, and a stronger faith than ever before. And for most of us, it doesn't come at the end of disasters like it did with Job here. For most of us, we go right into chapter 3 through 27. It doesn't come overnight for most of us, but if we hold fast, it will come. At the moment when faith is hardest and least likely, that's when God is working to develop in you and in me a faith that is stronger than the hurt and pain we feel. Would you pray with me? Our Father, we thank You for this book of Job. We thank You for the realism in it. We thank You for the truth found in it, the wisdom found in it. And so we ask, as we continue to make our way through this study, that You will continue to open our eyes to see You and believe in You, to see You more high and lifted up and exalted than we do now, and have a stronger faith than we do now. Holy Spirit, work in our minds and hearts. To that end, we pray. Amen.